This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The next Fed meeting on interest rates isn't until December 11th. There's a lot that could happen between now and then, of course, but some people at the Fed, not named Bernanke, said some interesting things today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the studios of Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, everybody. It's the 16th of November today. Good to have you here. We all know the chairman of the Federal Reserve is first among equals when it comes to monetary policy. But Ben Bernanke doesn't necessarily hold all the cards. Because when we talk about the Fed and interest rates, what we're actually making reference to is something called the Federal Open Market Committee, the 12 central bankers who actually vote on interest rates. In the past 24 hours, three separate members of the FOMC have said they didn't think there needs to be another rate cut. Ordinarily, that kind of news would land on about page 13 of the business section. But Wall Streeters who've been absorbing the recent raft of bad economic news have already started counting on the Fed to help them out. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
FedEx today cut its earnings forecast for the year, citing higher fuel costs and declining demand for deliveries. FedEx and other shippers are considered bellwethers of the overall economy's health. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve Board reported there was a 0.5% drop in industrial production last month. The tumble hit just about every manufacturing sector, from autos to housing to utilities. Economist Nigel Galt of Global Insight expects U.S. manufacturing output will decline for the last quarter of the year.
Anything related to housing is going down very sharply. The consumer is starting to pull back. The only place that's really strong is exports. And that's not enough at the moment to offset the weakness in housing and consumption.
While conceding the economy is going through a, quote, rough patch, Fed Governor Randall Krosner today said he doesn't foresee the need for more interest rate cuts. But economist Galt thinks the recent spike in oil prices will make consumers more frugal this holiday, and that's bound to get the Fed's attention.
I think sooner or later they're going to have to change their minds. I think the economy will probably be weaker than they're anticipating. Whether they change their minds as early as December, that's another question.
But for now, Fed members are signaling they're more concerned about inflation than recession, and financial markets have scaled back their expectations of another interest rate cut this year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The energy market continued its bewildering ways today. Crude jumped $1.50 to settle at a bit more than $95 a barrel. But gas prices fell just a tad, the first drop in weeks. $3.11 a gallon is the nationwide average now. You might think service station owners would be making some major money as pump prices rise. $3 a gallon, plus all the sodas, chips, and sundries they sell as we stop in to fill up. But today, the beleaguered British oil giant BP announced it's selling off its convenience stores and gas stations, laying off about 10,000 people in the process. Stacey Vanek-Smith reports others in the oil business are doing the same thing.
Royal Dutch Shell, Chevron, Exxon, and now BP have been sloughing off gas stations and convenience stores. Peter Butel is president of Cameron Hanover, an energy risk management firm. He says getting rid of gas stations is a smart way for oil companies to trim costs.
You've got a huge dog, this mastiff, which is the money they make on crude oil. You've got the tail, which is the money they make on refining, and then you've got a flea on the tail, which is the money they make by selling it to the public.
Butel says running gas stations was good business for oil companies back when crude prices were low, but now he says the slim margins just don't make sense.
They got into retail 50 years ago, and back then when crude oil was trading at $2 or $3 a gallon, you know, making 10 cents a gallon was good business.
But now they have to compete with discount giants like Costco and Walmart, says economist Philip Verlager. And he says there could be some pricey regulations coming down the pike.
Congress keeps looking at the companies and saying, well, we may want you at retail to do things like sell ethanol. Under those circumstances, it's better for the companies to tell Congress, well, we're not in that business anymore.
BP told Marketplace that it's just trying to streamline operations, and that's something many oil giants are doing. Despite sky-high oil prices, profits at big oil companies are down across the board. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Now, a story about a man whose influence is due in no small part to $100 a barrel oil. Venezuela is the fourth largest supplier of crude to the United States. President Hugo Chavez has called President Bush the devil and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice a true illiterate. And this past weekend at an economic summit, Chavez called former Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar a fascist. King Juan Carlos of Spain was there, and he responded with what was on many Spaniards' minds. He told Chavez literally to shut up. Now the king's all over YouTube, and Chavez is threatening Spanish businesses. From the America's Desk at WLRN in Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports on this escalating economic war of words.
In the video, the king of Spain leans forward and jabs his finger at Chavez. It's become an internet phenomenon, a political rallying cry, a ringtone for mobile phones.
I think a lot of people around the world actually have been saying it was high time that somebody actually challenged Hugo Chavez.
That's Wharton professor Mauro Guillén, himself a Spaniard. Chavez has reacted to the king's put down by threatening the future of Spanish business in Venezuela. He even mentioned banks Santander and BBVA as potential targets for nationalization. Guillén says Spanish multinationals have heard it all before.
So in Peru, under President Toledo, in Bolivia with Morales, in Argentina with Kirchner, Spanish companies have had trouble. They have learned how to cope with these situations. They essentially have to stay the course and wait until the storm dissipates.
Spain is the second largest investor in Latin America after the U.S., with $176 billion in total investments. But Spain is also a former colonizer, and therefore a target for populists like Chavez. Jerry Haar with Florida International University says Chavez is putting a chill on private enterprise.
His economic saber rattling is spooking present investors and certainly dissuading potential investors from coming into the market.
The business climate in Latin America has turned so hostile, new Spanish investment has dropped more than 90% since its peak in 1999. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
It was a positive end to a topsy-turvy 5 days on Wall Street. We'll have the details, and we'll check in with the man from Dallas when we do the numbers. Time to check the week on Wall Street with the guy that we do that with, David Johnson, down in Dallas, Texas. Hello, David.
Hello, Kai. Good to talk to you. Are they being nice to you up in football land?
They are, but I'll tell you, it's cold. It's cold. I want to go back to L.A.
At least variety. It's a spice of life. Now, see, that's the positive side of the stock market. You know,
you are so full of it, but go ahead.
Well, let me just try and see if this works.
Yeah, let me see.
So if it just went up every day, you wouldn't appreciate it.
That's true.
It's these little deep crevasses that really make you appreciate the good times.
Yeah, unless I miss my guess, though. I mean, it was up for the week, wasn't it?
Well, the Dow was up for the week. The S&P average was up for the week. The NASDAQ was up for the week. And I'm telling you, if you stop anybody on Wall Street or any stockbroker, any money manager anywhere, and ask them if it felt like it was an up week, mm-hmm. our collective response would be, are you crazy?
Yeah.
Look at what's going on out there.
Yeah, but that's exactly it. Why? Why doesn't it feel right?
Well, because it's not. I mean, there's been a steady stream, a drumbeat of bad news. We've had all these financial institutions, and it's just too numerous to mention, who've been writing down bad debts and looking for new CEOs and mm-hmm. wondering when the next shoe's going to drop and knowing that Imelda Marcos is out there someplace feeding these people's shoes. And then on the other hand, then we start looking around, and like yesterday, JCPenney, which is just a Cracker Jack retailer, came out, surprised everybody, and said business just stinks, and it just dropped off a cliff the last couple of months. And did you see the transportation?
Yeah, industry? I did. I was waiting for you to bring that up. You're a big transport guy, that FedEx thing, right?
Yeah, and I love that as a leading indicator, but FedEx came out and warned that business was drying up. So
are they priming the pumps here? Are they getting ready, lowering the bar, and is the recession word in the offing?
The recession word is out there, and they're mentioning it, and it is very commonplace. And there was an economist at Goldman Sachs today, of all people, who came out and said, you know, the hedge funds and the brokerages and the banks cutting $2 trillion of lending out, and it leads us to the possibility of a substantial recession. And so I went to my favorite economist, this guy David Kelly out of Boston. David said, Dr. Kelly said, don't listen to Wall Street economists.
Why not?
It was exactly what I said. And he said, because they're all worried about losing their jobs, are not getting a big bonus this year because the street's in such bad shape. And he said, they're out of touch. He said, I look at the classic signs out there. I look at employment. And then I look at valuation of the market. He said, it's not really overvalued. And if you have a recession, if we do go into recession, he said, I don't think you're going to. Then he said, I don't think it's going to be very bad. And the fact is, you know, we've been through 10 recessions in the last 60 years, and the market went up in 6 out of the 10.
Yeah, we're going to save this tape, and we're going to play it back for you in 6 months and see how you feel, all right?
All right. And then if you see a graveyard up there, I'd like to whistle.
Whistle right past it. Yeah, there you go. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a great weekend. Don't lose any money on the football game.
Yeah, right. All right, here we go. Coming up, our last installment of Consumed. Are you tired of rising gas prices? Well, Walmart sure is.
We believe that we could have a path of alternate fuels that would take you, let's say, from Detroit to Washington, D.C.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 66 points today, 0.5%, close at 13,176. The NASDAQ rose 0.7%, 18 points, 2637 is the number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 ended the day up 0.2%, 3 points, 1454 right there. The Dow was up 1% Monday through Friday. The NASDAQ and the S&P up 0.3%. The Dow Jones Sustainability World Index lost 0.3%, 4 points to close at 1387. Drink maker Cadbury Schweppes popped up more than 2%. Canned fruit company Del Monte Foods rose 0.4%. Cereal producer General Mills munched up more than 0.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note inched up to 4.17%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Consumed, American Public Media special series exploring the sustainability of our consumer culture. Online at consumed.publicradio.org. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. You're listening to Consumed, a special multi-show collaboration from American Public Media. It's about the future of the consumer economy. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it sustainable? The product of a year's work by teams of reporters, you'll want to catch all of this provocative series. Coming all week on Marketplace, Marketplace Morning Report, Speaking of Faith, and Weekend America.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. A report recommending reforms to America's exploding prison system population is released in Washington. An international conference gets underway in Brussels to discuss how to use indicators beyond the GDP
to measure the progress and well-being of nations. And are energy costs making shopping less jolly? The Consumer Federation of America and the Credit Union National Association released their annual survey on holiday spending and debt. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal, and we're back with Consumed, a special series on the consumer economy, airing on this and other American public media programs. There is a paradox that comes with all the spending that you and I do. This country's economic health depends on us buying more stuff every year. But more stuff is decidedly unhealthy in some other ways, like what it does to the climate, the strain it puts on natural resources, even how our buying habits affect our own bodies. We've spent this past week tossing around questions about the consumer economy and whether or not it's sustainable. Here's one more to wrap your brain around. Can Walmart save the world?
See this funny-looking light bulb? I got it at Walmart. It could save me $36 in electricity costs. But here's the really cool thing. If every Walmart shopper, all 180 million of us, would buy one of these, it would be like taking a million cars off the road.
Think about it. Millions of customers, thousands of stores, legendary power to cut prices could work. Here's what President and CEO Lee Scott told me last month.
I believe that we can put a vehicle on the street that is the best solution to sustainability.
Walmart in the car business, but I'm getting ahead of myself. 2 years ago this fall. During a meeting of Walmart employees in Bentonville, Arkansas, meetings that resemble pep rallies in more than a couple of ways, the world's biggest retailer promised a sustainability overhaul. It embraced everything from renewable energy to zero waste. To be honest, most outsiders back then thought all the hoopla was just that.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome your president and chief executive officer, Lee Scott.
But at this year's shareholder meeting, Lee Scott said the company's right about where it should be.
We will sell 100 million energy-efficient compact fluorescent light bulbs in the U.S. alone this year.
With Walmart's daily sales approaching $1 billion, we figured where better to wrap up a week of talking about consumption and its sustainability than Bentonville. So I got on a plane for Arkansas to talk to Lee Scott and to see how his plans are working out.
Well, this store looks good today, doesn't it?
The first thing you need to know about Walmart Supercenter store number 5260 is that it's Lee Scott's local store. So you ought to consider that when you picture it in your mind. Spick and span clean, those Walmart greeters may be a touch more friendly than at other stores. The other thing to know is that Lee Scott's not as crusty as his company's reputation. He's personable and folksy. He shows up right on time for our appointment at 7:30 on a Monday morning. Loafers, sport coat, no tie, carrying a McDonald's cup of coffee as we walk the aisles for a little show and tell.
These lights now on our freezer compartments.
They're actually coming on as we walk through.
They come on as you walk through. And so you have the electrical savings there.
The long rows of freezers with motion sensor lighting are just one example. Scott's promised his new stores will use 30% less energy than older ones. Then there are the products themselves.
Let's see where Hamburger Helper is. And they simply straighten the noodles out, and the noodles therefore nest better.
Walmart's been aggressive in reducing packaging for everything from Hamburger Helper to laundry detergent to breakfast cereals. Shelf after shelf after shelf of breakfast cereal.
One of the things they're working on is right here,
yeah.
This space.
Right, because this all settles in transport.
In a
so
box
you've got, of cereal. You've got 3 inches of this in a big Fruit Loops box.
Mm-hmm.
That's just wasted space in cardboard.
And that is where the cereal companies are working back through that very issue to give you the same tactile feel and the same storage ability, but to take that space out. It makes a huge difference.
Here's how huge. Walmart claims that by pushing its 60,000 suppliers to cut their packaging by 5%, it'll take 213,000 trucks off the roads and save 67 million gallons of diesel fuel a year.
All right, we never did find the Hamburger Helper.
All right, let's go see Hamburger Helper.
2 million people work at Walmart.
Oh, Mr. Murphy, how are you, sir?
Great, yourself?
I'm doing good.
600,000 of them have taken a personal sustainability pledge to go green at home as well as work. And if each one of those 600,000 brings a couple of family members on board...
How come we can't find Hamburger Helpers?
Then the company's daunting size delivers another payoff.
Pies, pots, canned meats, spaghetti sauce, it should be here.
Should be right
in
here.
We got Rice-A-Roni.
Oh, here, it's up, it's back here.
And canned goods.
Well, Scott claims no personal motivation for all this change. He says there wasn't an aha moment for him, just a realization that the company had to take advantage of its size to do something about sustainability. But once the relatively low-hanging fruit is gathered, like making those elusive boxes of Hamburger Helper even a little bit smaller, is Walmart ready to put any money where Lee Scott's mouth is?
We're not going to go out and outfit every individual store with solar energy panels or
why not
wind turbines. Well, because economically, there is no payback at this point to go out and do the entire chain.
So, a reality check. Walmart is still Walmart.
Yeah, it's not an altruistic endeavor.
That, critics say, is Walmart's essential core and why some think the company's efforts are doomed to fall short, no matter how many millions of people walk in the door looking for those everyday low prices. When we sat down to talk, I asked Lee Scott about that. Let's talk about those customers. You have 176 million of them a week. The way most of them do that is pile in the car and drive 3, 5, 8, 10, 12 miles, spewing out carbon dioxide and all those sorts of things. How do you take care of the downstream part of sustainability if you're Walmart?
Number one is because when you come to the super center, you're making one trip, and quite honestly, you can buy everything you need for life on that one trip.
But that's not the way people drive, right? They make 2, 3, 5 trips a week. If you take these stores, put them on the fringes of a suburban area, make people drive to them, is that model in and of itself then sustainable?
Oh, I think it's totally consistent. We believe that upstream, what we do in logistics, what we do with full trucks, what we do in managing the total electricity across the supply chain, actually it'll be hard for individual small stores to make that same kind of investment and have the same kind of impact on the environment.
The size and the scale that this company operates at really impose incredible opportunities. Play that out for me, and what's on your mind when you guys sit around and just spitball ideas?
Well, you have Sam's Clubs, which we have not talked about, but Sam's Clubs has fuel. Walmart does not have its own fuel. There's an opportunity for Sam's Clubs to set up national networks, whether it be with hydrogen or whether it be with alternative fuels in different ways. We believe that we could have a path of alternate fuels that would take you, let's say, from Detroit to Washington, D.C., fueling only at Sam's Clubs.
You have the ability, by your decisions that you make on a daily basis, to literally create a market.
Yes.
What's next?
The president of Sam's Clubs thinks there's an opportunity to participate in highly efficient vehicles of some kind. So how does that work? I think we can play a role in facilitating those technologies, not in necessarily owning those technologies, but in facilitating the use of those technologies.
Is there anything that's off the table that you're just not interested in even thinking about or trying?
No, the only thing we're not interested in trying is closing all of our stores and thinking somehow that's better for sustainability.
We asked, but nobody at Walmart would elaborate on what Lee Scott said, that bit about hydrogen fuel networks and sustainable cars. But really, Walmart doesn't have to make cars or anything else that's green to have an impact. All it has to do is put the order in, and its 60,000 suppliers will do the rest. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner caught up with some of them in Bentonville last month at a conference Walmart called to talk sustainability.
At a hotel near Walmart's Arkansas headquarters, CEO Lee Scott has just laid down a daunting challenge to hundreds of his company's biggest suppliers. He wants innovative, eco-friendly products that will, quote, drive sales. And he's brought in an army of earnest environmentalists. They stand behind booths ready to guide vendors along this green path.
Do you want to know about cotton?
Pardon me?
Do you want to know how cotton's grown?
Organic cotton, fair trade, carbon footprint calculators. It's a strange new world for many Walmart suppliers. But when a retail superpower like Walmart asks vendors to do something, it's rarely a question. However sweetly Lee Scott poses it.
It's not a hammer. It's not a threat. Over the long term, the people who don't participate, I think, will find that they probably do end up with less shelf space.
CEOs like Jim Chambers don't want that. He heads Cadbury Schweppes gum and candy business in North America. He says even something as seemingly trivial as the packaging around a piece of gum can chew up resources.
If we could cut the tolerances a little bit closer, so now it's in 15% less packaging. We see that as a win-win.
Other suppliers are biting into bigger changes. Take Kimberly-Clark. The company's been vilified by Greenpeace for using trees from ancient forests and too much virgin paper to make tissues and toilet paper. Not much changed until Walmart approached the company. That's the sound of production at a Kimberly-Clark factory that Greenpeace blockaded just 19 months ago. The Canadian plant is now churning out Kleenex Naturals, made with 20% recycled fiber. It's one of three such products Kimberly-Clark is trying out at Walmart's Prodding.
This has really focused CEO's attention.
Gil Friend heads up the eco-consulting firm Natural Logic, based in Berkeley, California. He contends Walmart's initiatives have packed more punch than any government regulation.
This is not just how do we comply with the law at the least possible cost. This is how do we keep shelf space in the biggest retailer in the world. That has a way of focusing the mind.
But David Nassar, executive director of Walmart Watch, says before leaning on its suppliers, Walmart and CEO Lee Scott need to take some of their own medicine.
If Walmart is truly serious about sustainability, then they need to accept some of the costs themselves. And so far, he's already rejected the idea of moving production, some production, any production, to the United States, which would help to curb greenhouse gas emissions because there'd be less distribution involved in the products.
Environmental guru Paul Hawken understands the critique. Still, he believes Walmart's sustainability campaign is huge.
It is a big deal.
Hawken says it's not just energy-efficient stores and less packaging. Just listen to what Lee Scott told Marketplace.
We can put a vehicle on the street that is the best solution to sustainability.
To Hawken, that suggests a tantalizing future for clean vehicles.
What Walmart's in a position to do is that they can properly position and create a vehicle that will be affordable, and this is where they're going, and I think it is revolutionary.
Hawken says Walmart could get in the business of selling, financing, and fueling a zero-emissions vehicle. But Hawken believes Walmart's eco initiative is even more fundamental than cars. He sees Walmart raising the environmental consciousness of working-class America. Whether Walmart will fully embrace the role of environmental champion, though, may ultimately depend on how it affects the company's bottom line. Shareholders care most whether Walmart's in the black, not the green. In Rogers, Arkansas, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. By the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
A final thought now about the series that you've been hearing all week on the program. When we started working on Consumed a year ago, what we wanted to do was get people thinking about the whole consumer economy, not just their individual slice of it, and whether the track that most of us seem to be on really is sustainable. That's obviously a loaded question. And to be honest, I expected more than our fair share of complaints or compliments in our inbox, and we've gotten some of both. But people who wrote haven't been talking about the actual stories, about Sam Eaton's Biotown or Tess Vigeland's dumpster diving for dinner with the Freegans in New York. If I'm reading the mail right, what we've done is raised some questions in your minds about how much longer this can keep going on. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 66 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq added 19.7%. The S&P 500 plumped up 3 points. That is 0.2% there. Thanks today to the staff here at Michigan Radio. Our series Consumed was produced by Margaret Koval. She had help from Stephen Gregory and Fiona Ng. Nicole Imbornone did most of the engineering. Our series wraps up this weekend on Speaking of Faith and on Weekend America from a city with an unquenchable thirst.
Hoover Dam is the dealer. Las Vegas is the crack whore.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.